Because they have to make decision collectively, they take a time. They may have to make more meeting and more. They have to spend more time and money. So I think there is trade-off. So depending on the situation, context, it can be good condition or not. It can be efficient or not. So and Heisman also said about monitoring cost. So the if the industry, the monitoring cost is very high, Quan might be a very good option, right? Because they don't need to pay a lot of monitoring cost. The workers can be committed without supervisor, right? So I think it's not, we cannot generalize this rule is, to all the club, because I think that industry is important, and then also like
I was going to say, in relation to what you're saying, if the company is big enough, you can have really low-level workers working really hard because they're going to be at the company for their career, and they know 20, 25 years down the line that their payoff can be bigger than what cooperatives can ever offer. And so there's this mentality as you start at the low level that you have this really strong work ethic that with the idea that you're going to get some sort of pension or your paycheck grows over 20-25 year period or something like that.
Well, co-ops can offer. There's no reason why co-ops can't offer even better long term, particularly for less skilled workers. If there is a co-op in which that kind of labor has a role, co-ops should be able to offer better pensions. Mm-hmm. You're Juhi? What, Juhi? Yeah. I think the point you made is really important, but I think we need to just add one other element to it, which is if you're working in a co-op, there's a whole range of values that you care about. You care about how enjoyable the work is, how much camaraderie there is, what kinds of cultural events are you going to organize, connected to your co-op, as well as just how hard are you going to work. So the narrowest aspect of labor process organization is much more efficient in co-ops. That is, mutual monitoring replaces foremen. So you save on those transactions costs. But to reach consensus on all these other things requires a lot more discussion and process than is needed in a capitalist firm where those issues never come into play. So I think the argument about governance is if co-ops were prepared to act just like a capitalist firm, they would have cheaper governance costs because they would save on the monitoring and everything else would be done in an authoritarian manner. They wouldn't have to discuss it. But they're not. That's the whole idea, that they want to be a community, not just a workplace. And that does increase the governance costs. That is, it takes time. So most long-term co-ops solve that by actually creating a managerial structure and not having endless meetings around all the things that managers decide. So they break apart the organizational life into strategic issues which workers are involved in and ordinary management, which is run often in a quite ordinarily hierarchical way.
I guess I wasn't thinking about a particular kind of democratic governance occurring within these co-ops. The model I'm thinking of is unions, which can be unbelievably efficient, at taking the demands of sometimes millions of workers, right, and translating them into sort of policies and actions. And I would think in many ways still gain greater, consent more easily than a corporation could, which is constantly dealing with small acts of resistance, throughout a large corporation. What I'm hearing is that co-ops are have to be a more consensus-based sort of group. Is that
Just like to go on the union example, they are very efficient. They can be, but they once they stop engaging their rank and file, they're not able to make those things happen anymore. So it's not just like a top down or telling all our members what to do. They have to still engage the members and keep them involved, and that's what is time consuming and costly.
Amber, you going to raise that?
I guess I was, yeah, I mean, I think that is it is time-consuming and costly, but I guess the successful ones, either whether they're unions or working co-ops, figure out how to be, how to align as many members' interests as possible. It's just that these members' interests are very complex depending on where they are in their life and many of the issues that Eric raised, you know, and so a successful co-op figures out how to make that process of aligning those interests as efficient as possible, and it's a challenge. So.
Yeah.
To add to that is that, and I also think that the cooperatives, when you have a committed base of owners, you've got a very disparate range of interests. While you may have committed to the concept, I still think you have a broad range of interests, which are perhaps more time-consuming and require more energy to align them in some fashion, if you can, to work them out, to figure them out, because people are concerned about it, whereas perhaps in a capitalist firm, it's going to run more single-handedly along economic terms in terms of I like the price or I don't like the price, or I like, you know, versus a myriad, you know, of issues related to your institution or to your cooperative.
And I think that was also, I mean, in the papers and the reading list for the seminar, I think that was also, that's also the problem in defining a kind of more general, like getting a more general concept for the social economy, because the capitalist economy is quite simple to kind of characterize, like the organizations, because they're all organized, you know, along the profit principle, whereas I think in like the social economy, it's a broader concept, it's just much more difficult to kind of grasp the concept, because they operate according to many more dimensions, right? Like, it is not only profit, it is not only, like, means of production. It can be, like, all kinds of causes. So it becomes more of a normative, more broader kind of spectrum, how to kind of define those organizations. And I guess that's the difficulty in finding, like, a general universal kind of concept. For the corporation, for the organization, so it's on a higher level.
I would agree with that, but I mean, just operating in a capitalist market or, you know, being profit driven, I think it's, I don't see as necessarily being a parameter that demarcates, you know, what belongs to social economy and what doesn't. It more, I mean, I think when I see, you know, this transformation and whether social economy can be an alternative to capitalism, so in the long run, it seems to me that, you know, everything comes to the ideological problem. I mean, if, like, even in this case of, you know, very high-skilled technology people and, you know, who should stay in these co-ops because ideologically they support that paradigm or that project, that seems to be crucial, and I think that also is crucial in other things. It's not really, I mean, I honestly think that operating according to the rules of the capitalist market and system, there's no way that, you know, I mean, it's very few or very difficult for a co-op or any organization to be more efficient or to produce cheaper. It's difficult. As long as you can produce, but you need a customer, a pool of customers who would be willing to pay maybe more, you can survive in that way. But that also requires an ideological, if you really want to be long-term. I mean, if it's not just for, you know, showing up and going back home and telling our neighbors, oh, you know, I went to this co-op and how nice. If you really want it to be something long-term and consistent, it really has to be ideologically based, I think. And then it then, you know, turns out to the goes to this Gramsci issue again. And then, you know, it's a long-term and some. So it's just for profit and not for profit. I mean, it's just, it's not, I think, the defining parameter in that.
Mm-hmm. ideology.
Oh yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
I guess two things. One that comes out of the discussion we were having a minute ago, and then one, you the bell went off in my head when you said Gramsci. But the first thing is that it sounds like, in general, there's a speed factor. Capitalists, because they don't have to worry, or if they choose not to, they don't have to worry about many of the things that a typical co-op would have to worry about. They are, in many cases, capable of making decisions and moving into places, especially on larger scales, on average, faster than a typical co-op would be able to. And it would be certainly true in a startup phase if they had access to the right amount of capital. So that gets back to Steve's earlier question, why would we ever think that capitalist firms would outcompete worker co-ops? Maybe that's part of it. The Gramsci bell was that a lot of what's in Real Utopia's envisioning Real Utopia's book could be construed as a dialogue between war of position and war of maneuver, and what that all means. What do people think about that? And was that in your? I'm also curious to know how much, if at all, that was in your head as you were developing it all.
In the third part of the book, the contrast between ruptural transformations and interstitial echoes the militaristic metaphor of Gramsci's war of maneuver versus war of position. The whole military metaphor was something I didn't like, especially because it presupposes that it's not a metamorphosis idea. It's in Gramsci's, the war of maneuver, the war of position was entirely in the service of the war of the war of position was in the service of the war of maneuver. Ultimately, you had to attack, and it's just that sometimes you couldn't, so you had to kind of build your ramparts and maintain your position, but ultimately you want to destroy. As opposed to a notion that the transformative practices actually have the effect of changing the structure, as opposed to just building a counter-hegemony to attack the structure. And I didn't want to prejudge that issue. I'm not, as I said in my earlier comments, it's not that I have a definitive argument for the transformative potential of interstitial transformation, but I didn't want to presuppose that it was in this battle modality. That may be correct, but I didn't feel it should be a presupposition. So, but there is a connection, obviously, and I think in the Gramscian idea. In our discussion so far, we have been pretty much equating cooperatives with the social economy, whereas in the readings, the social economy includes lots of things which aren't necessarily co-ops in the conventional sense. Some of the readings we'll be doing do argue that that as a general principle, social economy activities are democratic, but they're not necessarily co-ops. That is, the members don't necessarily own the organization in which they work. They don't have any property rights in it. Whereas in a worker co-op, the distinctive feature of that particular kind of enterprise is that the workers invest resources which they privately own, that is, you know, that's savings or retained earnings or whatever that they own in the cooperative. And they are collectively the owners of it. And then there's different forms of worker-owned firms. There's different rules by which they can either take out their shares or not, they get a return on their investment or not. There's different ways in which it's organized, but it's still the case that the workers are the owners of the enterprise. Lots of social economy organizations are not like that. The members don't own the organization. They can be owned. They can be owned as a nonprofit foundation, for example, in which the assets are not owned by the people who work there. Not owned by any, you know, the depends upon the rules, the legal rules for the creation of a nonprofit organization. A nonprofit firm can be such that if the firm dissolves, a test for who owns something is what happens if it ceases to exist, where do the assets go, right? So one view, one type of organization, you've got buildings, you've got land where you hold your offices. If the organization ceases to exist, who, and you sell it, who gets the money from the sale? Well, a nonprofit foundation. The money has to be designated to some other nonprofit foundation. Can't go to the people who work there. The, you know, the CEO of the foundation doesn't own the foundation and has no claims on the assets of that foundation. If the foundation ceases to exist, the assets are dispersed according to some rule to other nonprofit foundations. So that's not a worker co-op. That has a different, the members are not the residual claimants on the surplus. In a co-op, the workers are the owners of the surplus. And that's the sense in which co-ops are sometimes thought of as closer to capitalist firms than would be a, for example, what's in the Quebec case is called a solidarity co-op, or a stakeholder co-op. A solidarity co-op, if they make a surplus, it doesn't get distributed to its members. The surplus is reinvested in facilities, or there'd be some other device for its allocation, but it can't go to the private incomes of the members. The governance of a solidarity co-op would also be different. It's, a solidarity co-op is governed by, not by the employees, the workers in it, but by a board of directors consisting of clients, workers, and often community members. Would be a typical stakeholder council. So the workers would be a caucus within the stakeholder council, and so the workers might have their own assembly to choose delegates for the board and to discuss whatever issues are in play, but the actual governance would be by a board that would include people outside of the actual workers. And you know, this relates to that grid sort of thing, that as we think about the social economy, I also think of worker co-ops as a really pivotal category within it, because it brings into play so many of the themes around the social economy as an alternative to capitalism. But I don't think we should treat the worker co-op as coterminous with this conceptual space. It's a key component of it, but not by any means the only. Yeah.
I want to raise up the question. So why social economies can be alternative, to the capitalism in terms of making social empowerment? Like someone said, it necessarily it asks to people gather together and associate together, and maybe it can make people people are more educated, make people educated or something. Why does this kind of social economies contribute social empowerment in many ways and in which ways? Am I clear? Sorry.
I wasn't entirely clear, but the question also should be directed at the discussion, not just at. So you're asking, how does the social economy contribute to social empowerment?
Yeah.
As a general matter.
Yeah. So, is it because of the democratic characteristic in make of people, is it because the democratic characteristic to make people associate together and discuss together and make decisions together? That's the thing, or because it internalized the externalities in many externalities, or the other things?
The social empowerment aspect of these activities comes from the mobilization of participation through persuasion and discussion, and thus is captured by the notion of the democratic aspects. It's that aspect which enables, I think, a deeper consideration of externalities than is the case in a capitalist firm, and a consideration of a wider range of values for the enterprise or for the activity than simply maximizing profits. But the criterion, the way that I've tried to map out these economic structures is by focusing on the nature of the power relations that get forged based on these different, these three different types of power, and then how how those are linked together. So the socially empowered aspect comes from the fact that it does involve mobilizing people for cooperative action, as opposed to mobilizing money to direct people or mobilizing coercion to control people. So that is the socially empowered aspect. And it's the reason why co-ops have a good claim in general to be at least partially in this category. That is, they're one of the ways in which social power can be increased, because co-ops are based on bringing people together for deliberative associational activity. Sometimes co-ops become more like partnerships, and they can easily then, you know, develop into a particular kind of special capitalist firm. So the co-ops are, in general, you know, somewhat of a hybrid organization. Is that clear?
I think the whole reason that people establish these things are going to be really different across contexts, like kind of getting to what you're talking about, just in my little slice of reality, socialists in Minneapolis, they had like an inside strategy and an outside strategy, and we had like a lot of workers' collectives, and we tried to make a federation of workers' collectives, and then you had your parties, and those were kind of like the inside strategy that, you know, you can just go and you can feel home, and you can have like these long-term commitments and kind of have that in abeyance. But then you also had your outside strategy, which is more kind of towards like the ruptural thing, where you're out there trying to like agitate folks and try to recruit them over to your side. So I guess like in my experience, people never thought of these kinds of things as going to replace capitalism. It's just there, because if you do overthrow capitalism, you don't want to just have this vacuum.
Yeah, if it should just happen in the United States that we wake up one morning and capitalism is gone, we've got to have something already.
One of the ways that I was trying to resolve my frustration with making sense of what sort of fit in this box of social economy and what didn't, and why certain things seemed different, some categories of things seemed different even though they were in the same larger box, was trying to think about what was anti-capitalist versus what was non-capitalist. And thinking through it, what I thought might be one dimension to look at would be whether or not, and I think Eric, your chapter 8, I think it really gets at this, what is rooted in the, what is directly attacking, if you will, or changing the social relations on which economic power is based, that would be anti-capitalist, versus non-capitalist, which is maybe some broader set of social goals that provide some service to a group that doesn't currently get services, or addresses some societal need that's not currently being addressed by the market. Now, I mean, indirectly, they may be tied to, you know, capitalism's market's not serving people. But, you know, I think that led me at least to think, all right, you know, if you have anti-capitalist versus non-capitalist, you're going to have different achievability, viability, et cetera. You're going to have different opponents, people who are going to have interest, non-interest, you're going to get different resistance, et cetera. I don't know if that's a useful way. I mean, maybe developing that anti-capitalist, non-capitalist distinction might be useful.
So that way of framing a contrast would say non-capitalist is a way of dealing with market failures of one sort or another, but in a way that leaves markets intact. That is, capitalist markets are not affected. It's just they fail to do certain things, and then you figure out an alternative way of doing those things that capitalism doesn't do. So that's the equivalent of the state engaging in various reactive things to deal with market failures. So the state introduces Social Security to deal with old age pensions because there's basically a market failure in providing subsistence to the elderly. Markets can't do that. People get upset when the elderly die and starve, and for reasons other than the reaching the full end of life. And so the state steps in. Social Security is not anti-capitalist, it's non-capitalist. And it's non-capitalist in a way that, in that case, is actually functional for capitalism. It reduces some pressures.
Pro-capitalist.
Yeah.
Well, pro-capitalist insofar as it's functional. It's not pro-capitalist in the sense that it is...
Structurally.
It's structurally capitalist, but it serves to stabilize the system. Not all non-capitalist things would have that character. But some non-capitalist things just meet an unmet need, which if it wasn't met would just be an unmet need. It might make people miserable, but it doesn't in any way undercut capitalism. But
some could be considered pro-capitalist in terms of allowing, say, wages to be lower because new
right,
wages
so
are filling in needs and allowing for...
Right. And some of these things could be harmful to capitalism without being anti-capitalist. If, for example, you have a welfare safety net that reduces the pressure of the reserve army of labor, which therefore enables labor markets to be a little tighter and therefore raises wages, that would be something which capitalists would object to. It's why they object to all sorts of solutions to market failures. But it isn't anti-capitalist in the sense of actually threatening any basic principle of capitalism. It's just not—it's just suboptimal from the point of view of capitalists. I mean, and the question is, does anti-capitalist have to actually pose an anti-capitalist principle,
right,
or just be something which is suboptimal for capitalism?
I mean, the way I was thinking about it, anti-capitalist efforts arise from, you know, individuals, groups being unhappy with the oppression that comes out of this economic power. So it's, you know, it's workers forming a cooperative so they don't have to sell their labor power. And that way, I think, you know, what we were just referring to, you know, this social safety net is anti-capitalist, and that, you know, the basic requirement of capitalism is that some people have to sell their labor power in order to survive. And so that would be anti-capitalist in the same way that a worker cooperative is anti-capitalist, that I don't have to sell my labor power to you.
This is actually moving towards a more complex mapping, but as you began with the binary of non-capitalist versus anti-capitalist, you could have some anti-capitalist innovations of the sort you're describing, which nevertheless were functional for capitalism.
For sure.
Because they could reduce pressure. They could make the system work better, even if the reason why people are opting for them is because they want to exit capitalism. Yeah, Nate.
So I was also thinking about a lot of the social economy things as things that are initially fitting into market failure spaces, but what if instead of the intentionality of the effort being anti-capitalist or not, whether it's anti-capitalist or not is a market share, just whether it goes from filling a market failure to then eroding the market share of capitalist firms, which, you know, you don't need to have any particular intention or not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, say the dairy industry here in the U.S. has 80% market share in co-ops, but has that really eroded the power of, you know, so...
That's another problem.
Interesting.
What kind of co-ops are they?
Well, no, but I mean, within your construct, I mean, they have eroded the power of some capitalist firms.
And also I feel the need that, I mean, capitalism should be since it's a global system, you know, this entire discussion really has to be, you know, backed up with an analysis or definitely a consideration of the state. We said this earlier, but I mean, the only way, like, for example, we might talk about very favorable, nice developments in a, let's say, in a developed country, you know, co-ops forming, many of them, so people don't have to sell their labor power, but it really doesn't affect many big capitalist firms because they're already in other developing countries, and that again turns the issue to the state and international, basically national institutions. And of course, that again turns the issue to the power situation. And it turns out to be a vicious cycle. And I mean, I don't know. What do you think about it?
We have to avoid, however, whether the move is just within countries or globally, the view that unless something is actually threatening to capitalism, that is posing on the horizon an alternative that could replace it, it doesn't count as anti-capitalist. You know, so we can easily, in an era where there is no systemic threat to capitalism, even with this big crisis, there's no systemic threat in the sense of any challenge capable of replacing capitalism with an alternative. It's easy, therefore, to, I think, incorrectly treat all social practices which, as practices, violate capitalist principles and pose an alternative, are therefore not really, you know, don't really count as anti-capitalist. The market share criteria seems like a reasonable one to think about. I mean, I don't object to that. But if increasing the market share of non-capitalist things helps to stabilize capitalism, do we not, you know, do we assess it differently? Well, stabilizing it today versus posing long-term alternatives by demonstrating to people that they can live an alternative way of life. Mondragon in the Basque Country is perfectly compatible with capitalism. It's part of a supply chain where it produces parts for Volkswagen and General Motors, or it used to for General Motors. I don't know if it does anymore, but it buys capitalist firms and has some subsidiaries which are functioning just like capitalist firms. So do we want to then treat Mondragon as simply a variant of capitalism, which some people do, because it's so compatible with capitalism? Or, on the other hand, do we want to really see this as a persistent thorn and signal that even large-scale, high-tech, advanced industrial production can be organized under very different ways, which then, in particular circumstances like the current economic crisis, behaves very differently from capitalist firms? Yeah, Matt.
The answer could be both, in a way, to try to further flesh out this typology. These pro-capitalist entities, whether they're policies like Social Security or firms like Mondragon, some of them could still exist in a non-capitalistic system. Like Social Security, or some form of it, could still be there. Mondragon could still be there if suddenly we were not in a capitalist system anymore, or had somehow completed a transition. Other types of things would not be able to exist in a capitalist system, like a foundation that, like the Gates Foundation, which holds its money in investments. I mean, not only would they not have been able to build up the wealth in the first place, but they wouldn't be able to invest it in the way that they do. So there's pro-capitalist organizations that could exist in capitalism or not in capitalism. And there's pro-capitalist organizations that are not themselves capitalist, but could only exist in capitalism.
And isn't it possible to sort of try to look for signals that a firm is anti-capitalist? I mean, to me, democracy, true democracy, is one of those signals, you know. So I think that even within that, your that idea that most of these social economy organizations exist within a capitalist system and may be enabling capitalism, or there still are so many variations within that, and it does seem like it's possible, and I think these articles are trying to do that, to, you know, what are the signals that, what is the collection of signals that say that this is trying to create, these organizations are trying to create something different. And ideology is an interesting one, because, I mean, I guess knowing something about, you know, if you look in history, the trouble is that ideology, how many generations does it last? I mean, that's the classic thing to say in co-ops, is that it only lasts perhaps three, but often no more than, you know, one generation.
Also, I think if you talk about, like, viable alternatives, you kind of have to move the analysis up from just an organization level to, like, a collection, like a network of organizations, like the... Like in Quebec, you know, where they've got like this superstructure that kind of like coordinates different kind of
that's
elements.
Another signal, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think the emphasis on ideology is a really intriguing one in this context. One might even want to make the claim that the fact that there will be that we can predict a tendency for the erosion of ideological commitment over time in cooperatives, but not in capitalist firms. That is, capitalists remain ideologically committed to capitalism generation after generation.
It's an interesting issue.
That could be almost the definition of what it means to be in a capitalist world. Right? That is, the difficulty of reproducing over time the kind of commitment that would make this system work just fine. You know, if we could snap our fingers and have everybody who starts a co-op become intergenerationally committed to co-ops, then the Proudhonian vision of co-ops just gradually taking over the world would seem a perfectly plausible strategy, because you could start small, you get people hooked in, and then they wouldn't be tempted by exit options, even when the exit options were better for them personally, because of their feeling this is a better way of life. They're creating an alternative world, and the alternative world could, you know, be like cancer, which sort of, well, can't, like the Asian carp in the Mississippi, they just sort of take over Lake Michigan. One way of thinking about the Gramscian problem of hegemony and counter-hegemony is what it means for a system to be hegemonic is that it has these self-replicating mechanisms for the dominant ideology and self-corroding mechanisms for the challenging ideology in place. And therefore, it takes heroic efforts to create counter-hegemonic possibilities that are themselves reproducible over time. They will always tend to deteriorate over time. That would be one way of characterizing that. Now, the question is, what's the upshot of that? Is the implication of that, once again, a reinforcement of pervasive pessimism and sort of the impossibility thesis? You know, so some of you, again, have heard this particular thing. Marx had a solution to this problem, which was the belief that capitalism destroyed its own conditions of possibility. So he had an autonomous basis for believing that capitalism destroys itself. It was independent of the robustness of its ideological mechanisms or the difficulty of counter-hegemony. So that counter-hegemony becomes possible because capitalism destroys itself, and at some point it's going to be in shambles. And that's the context in which then those mechanisms of ideological reproduction no longer work. Right? So the
counter-hegemony becomes stronger as the system gets weaker.
Right. But it's not that the system became weaker because counter-hegemony became stronger, right? So Marx insisted that the system becomes weaker for reasons other than the increasing strength of counter-hegemony, even though the increasing strength of counter-hegemony is absolutely fundamental to the possibility of transcending capitalism. But it's not that which destroys capitalism, or which weakens capitalism. It's its crisis tendencies and its laws of motion. That's the guts of historical materialism. It's as a theory of history, not just as an historical theory, but as a theory of history. And that's the part of the theory which I think is particularly shaky. It's part of the theory which I don't myself have confidence in. I don't have confidence in the ability to argue that the contradictions of capitalism intensify in such a way as to make system reproduction ever more precarious, in such a way as to weaken its mechanisms of ideological coherence, in such a way as to make counter-hegemony progressively stronger. I mean, all of those chains in the causal structure, I think, are problematic.
For example, you don't see the environment as a potential bottleneck?
Well, it's possible it is. I mean, it's possible that if the environmental calamities that are being predicted because of the mechanisms that are invoked are as likely to produce a kind of authoritarian statism of new forms of massively repressive barbarism as it is. There's nothing in those mechanisms. There's nothing in the mechanism of environmental crisis that produces collective solidarities of the sort that would provide for a democratic egalitarian alternative.
But that's beside the point, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean,
the point is, does capitalism destroy it? Exactly. If the question is, does capitalism destroy itself, and what replaces it is the second question.
Yeah, but is that capitalism destroying itself or industrialism destroying itself?
Yeah.
And it's also not clear that under a world of global warming with catastrophic environmental collapse that capitalists can't make a huge profit off of that. But that undermines their ability to accumulate.
They create new markets of carbon.
the capitalist form of organizing the production and appropriation of surplus isn't obviously threatened by ecological destruction. Ecological destruction destroys lots of lives, and will create all sorts of infrastructural needs for seawalls and whatever, but why those can't be produced by capitalist firms under contract, to dredge and, this may be kind of irrelevant illustration. The fantastically effective seawalls in the Netherlands that prevent flooding and enable a country below sea level to exist, which could be a model for the way much of coastal areas will have to be. It's been successfully done in the Netherlands. The Dutch government has played a key role, but the actual seawalls were built by private contracts. I mean, the government doesn't own construction companies to build those things. It had bids, and capitalist firms built the stuff. So it's not entirely so obvious that the environmental mechanism, Marx's mechanism, destroyed capitalism from its central mechanism. That is, it made accumulation impossible because of the falling rate of profit. Whereas environmental mechanisms just disrupts economic activity generically without necessarily, and indeed the destruction of capital that occurs, the sort of crisis mechanism of destroying capital creates all sorts of new opportunities for investment. So, I don't know if environmental, the environmental thing would have to work through the collective actions it triggers as people come to realize that capitalism can't solve these problems.
But I have to say, I don't see how, even from the ideological point of view, people who would say that, capitalism doesn't solve environmental problems and in fact creates it, would reach the conclusion that socialism is the way. I mean, that is a very weak link, and in fact that is a very difficult one. I mean, people might return or invent other ways of living, but I mean, I see socialism as a very vague, especially given the current structural and cultural context, as a very vague option, unfortunately.
Well, those are of course the reasons why the idea of building democratic and empowered alternatives to the extent we can as a way of demonstrating that certain kinds of problems can be more effectively solved when people are in control over solving them. That's the ideological aspiration of these kinds of initiatives with respect to larger scale initiatives. We're after five. It's been a for me, an interesting and productive first shot. So next time, so just to remind everyone of our collective decisions, next week is a Haven Center week. I would encourage people to come to the Haven Center lecture as well. It bears in the broadest sense on the same domain of themes, even though it's not on the social economy. We will then meet at 7:30 here. One possibility of, if people do go to the Haven Center thing, then there'll be time, I guess. That finishes at 5:30, so there'll be time to have dinner in between that and here as well. I have on occasions had evening seminars where we ordered pizza as well, but in the end that ends up just being a lot of extra complication, and I'm not proposing that we at least immediately do that. Okay, I'll send an email around with an updated schedule and get your interrogations to me by midnight on Monday, and I will get them back to you by Tuesday evening.